welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. On this episode, we have an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Stacy Schiff by the writer Karen Carbo. It took place at Wordstock on November 7, 2015. Schiff joined us to talk about her book, The Witches, Salem, 1692. Schiff has written on a variety of subjects, but one of her most important contributions is in revealing the complexities of the lives of female historical figures by recreating their eras. She does this so well that people often refer to her books as reading like a novel. The results have been rich works of nonfiction that focus on a variety of women and eras from Vera Nabokov to Cleopatra to the women of the Salem witch trials. The choice of interviewer, of course, is no accident. Carbo is one of Oregon's great nonfiction writers, having published 14 award-winning books. A great deal of her work also explores the contributions by women to society, most notably in her best-selling Kick-Ass Women series, featuring Julia Child, Georgie O'Keeffe, Coco Chanel, and Audrey Hepburn. This conversation is a pleasure to listen to, not only for its depth, but because Schiff and Carbo play off each other for some pretty funny moments.
We're so happy, I think speaking for Stacy, we're so happy to be in this beautiful building, which is also a church, given the topic that we're going to be discussing. So, I'm beyond thrilled. I've admired Stacy's work for many, many years. Her Vera book is one of my all-time favorite books, and I am just thrilled and humbled to be able to hold this conversation. So what I'd like to do, though, before we sort of start talking, is to ask Stacy to read a few pages, sort of contextualizing, you know, what it meant to be a witch. Like, that word is sort of bandied about so much in contemporary times that I think it's really important to hear what people considered witchcraft, what kind of behavior, and also it's really interesting because European witches did different things than... I want to say American witches, but it was no America, right? Than Bay Colony
North American
witches.
American witches, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So please.
I was a chapter or so into the book before I realized that I hadn't explained what a witch was. So here were the pages that resulted. What exactly was a witch? Any 17th century New Englander could have told you. Adversarial though the relationships were, the court officials, the accused, and the accusers all envisioned the same figure. Directly or indirectly, they drew their definition from Joseph Glanvil, a distinguished English academician and naturalist. With unimpeachable authority, the Oxford-educated Glanvil had proved that witchcraft existed as plainly as heat or light. As he defined the term, a witch is one who can do, or seem to do, strange things beyond the known power of art and ordinary nature by virtue of a confederacy with evil spirits. From those pacts, witches assumed their power to transform themselves into cats, wolves, hare. They had a particular fondness for yellow birds. A witch could be male or female, but was most often female. An English witch in particular maintained a kind of menagerie of imps or familiars, demonic mascots that did her bidding. Cats and dogs were prevalent, although toads were a universal favorite. The witchcraft literature is thick with toads, burned toads, exploding toads, dancing toads, groaning toads, pet toads, pots of toads, human bored toads, toads, cats disguised as toads. The 16-year-old servant who slipped a plump toad into the family milk pitcher delivered an explicit message, as she fully intended. Witches had troubled New England since its founding. They drowned oxen, caused cattle to leap 4 feet from the ground, tossed skillets into the fire, tipped hay from wagons, enchanted beer. They launched apples, chairs, embers, candlesticks through the air. They sent forth disembodied creatures, in one case, a man's head connected to a white tail by several feet of nothingness, a Cheshire cat centuries before Lewis Carroll. It should be said that there were a fair number of taverns in the colony. That was a fun sentence to write. Salem Town was particularly well served with 15 taverns or one establishment for every 80 men, women, and children. Witches alternately charmed and disabled. They manage to be two places at once, to emerge dry from a wet road, to walk soundlessly over loose boards. They arrive too quickly, divine the contents of unopened letters, spun suspiciously fine linen, new secrets for bleaching cloth, survived falls downstairs. They could be muttering contentious malcontents, or they could be inexplicably strong and unaccountably smart. They often committed the capital offense of having more wit than their neighbors. As her former minister had said of the third Massachusetts woman hanged for witchcraft in 1656. Compared to their European counterparts, New England witches were a tame bunch, their powers more ordinary than occult. They specialized in disordering the barn and kitchen. When the New England witch suspended natural laws, they tended to be agricultural ones. She had no talent for storms or weather of any kind. She neither called down plague nor burned Boston. Continental witches had more fun. They walked on their hands. They made pregnancies last 3 years. They turned their enemies' faces upside down and backward. They flew internationally. They rode hyenas to bacchanals deep in the forest. They stole babies and penises. They employed hedgehog familiars. The Massachusetts witch's familiars were unexotic by comparison. She did not venture very far afield. Even in her transgressions, she was puritanical. She rarely enjoyed sexual congress with the devil. When she visited men in the night, she seemed interested mostly in wringing their necks. Prior to 1692, the New England witch seldom flew to illicit meetings, more common in Scandinavia and in Scotland. While there was plenty of roistering in New England, little of it occurred at witches' Sabbaths, which seldom featured depravity, dancing, or voluptuous cakes, and took place in broad daylight. The witch's ultimate target, the point of all those pricks and pinches, was the soul rather than the body. And despite her prodigious power, she did not break out of jail, something many less advantaged New Englanders managed with ease.
So, you know, one of the things that I think is quite amazing about the book, and I think it was we've talked before, and it was a starting place for you, was that you assumed that what was happening to them was real. You assumed that witchcraft was real. And in fact, for those people, it was like gravity. It was not something that you had to reach to believe. It was just an accepted part of life. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because obviously the whole incident, which was actually very short-lived, right? It was only like 9 months or 10 months.
9 months from start to finish, yeah.
But this basic belief, even though there was no corporeal evidence often, was sort of what triggered it. Could you sort of say how it began? And
The whole thing seems so strangely delusional. That it seemed to me that you can't understand how it happened or understand why anyone would act this way if you didn't buy into what they were seeing and if you didn't understand that to them a witch is as clear as heat or light, that a witch is a force of nature and there to be reckoned with. And so I knew from early on, for example, there's a woman who will confess to witchcraft, an older farm woman, who will tell the justices when they are deposing her at her preliminary hearing that she has flown on a stick with her neighbor over the trees from Andover, Massachusetts to Salem, Massachusetts to attend a diabolical Sabbath, and that en route during that flight, she would crash, the two of them would crash. And she knew that had happened because she still had the pain in her leg, which tells you something about how much she believes her own testimony, that she can still feel the results of this, right, of this mishap. So I always knew that was sort of where I needed to start, and that you had to be able to accept their belief and how fundamental this belief was to the faith.
Well, and what's the other thing that's interesting to me is that the main accusers initially were young, preteen girls, and that all of their convulsions and everything that was happening to them was taken at face value. You know, I imagine, you know, we have daughters, if they were acting up, that we might say, oh, come on, for God's sakes. Well, we wouldn't say that. But, you know, that their behavior...
Some of us might, actually.
We might even use stronger language, in fact. But, so talk about the early accusers. How did this whole thing get going?
two little girls, one nine and one eleven, the daughter and the niece of the Salem Village minister, will start to convulse and fall into trances and shriek and roar and speak gibberish. Their bodies contort. They try to fly across the room. They will start interrupting ministers at sermon. At night, they will sleep like babies. They don't particularly want to pray, and they're not particularly inclined to do their chores. But no one notices that part. But the paroxysms conform precisely to what had been understood to be either possession or witchcraft. There had been a prior case in Boston a few years earlier of several bewitched children, including a boy in that case, and the symptoms were identical, only more acute in the case of Salem. So although no one jumps to the immediate conclusion they are bewitched, once it is determined that they are suffering the effects of witchcraft, no other diagnosis presents itself. Medicine is very primitive at this point. And moreover, these are precisely the symptoms which the foamings, the trancings, the trances, the stranglings feeling that people understand to be witchcraft. Once they are assumed to be bewitched, obviously they need to name a witch. And three names are produced immediately. There are three sort of vulnerable women, one of them a slave, one of them a very litigious older woman, and one of them the local beggar woman.
Right. I think, you know, one of the things that I love so much about the book is that, you know, you're telling a very oft-told tale. Like, everyone who kind of has graduated from fourth grade in this country knows the story of the Salem witch trials. But the way in which you contextualize the whole thing and you know, make it live for us contemporary readers, I just think is astonishing. Talk a little bit about this role of litigation, that the Bay colonists were very litigious because somebody had to be at fault for this behavior. It couldn't be just sort of a random occurrence, or maybe you have, you know, epilepsy, or again, as you said, medicine was rudimentary, but the idea that this was going to be something that was going to be litigated. Talk about,
you know,
that.
There's so much of this particular tragedy that is seminal and sort of hardwired in our DNA. And one does wonder if the fact that these people are exceedingly litigious might explain something. They are always in court. And in fact, very few people who are accused during the trials have not already been in court for some other reason, whether it was debt or drunkenness or trespass. There's a lot of fornication in Massachusetts earlier. And reading those quarterly court cases is really fascinating because you begin to see how contentious relationships were, where the fault lines are, how easily and often people sued, and you realize that there's a lot of unfinished business here, which obviously witchcraft will help to finish off in many ways. I should probably add that there were no lawyers in Massachusetts in 1692. And in fact, a few years earlier, a letter has gone out to London saying, could you please send us a few honest lawyers if such a thing exists in nature? So all of this is being done by justices of the peace, but that sense that someone, that somehow blame can be should be assigned, and that a verdict can be reached, and that everything has a reason is very central to Puritanism, and it makes of these people really natural litigants.
Right, and there were ministers, and there were magistrates, and the magistrates were really sort of like city fathers. Like they didn't have any sort of special ability to discern the truth, right? They were just sort of. So you have, I guess the thing is that's so fascinating is there's a lot of different people with a lot of different agendas, and one of the things that you just spoke about is sort of getting even with one's neighbors, right? So.
Witchcraft cleans up a lot, cleans up the neighborhood in many ways.
Right.
And if you had it's almost like a magnetic force that, you know, this glinting attraction for people who have any kind of unfinished business, whether it's envy or greed or unrequited love or love gone wrong. I mean, for everyone who's accused, you can come up with some, at least, collection of reasons. There are a few mysteries. And there's no central hunt here. There's no central reason to explain everybody. But you can almost always come up with some collection of reasons.
Right.
Rebecca Nurse, for example, who's this, you know, very innocent, pious, old farm woman, she maybe didn't sit in the meeting house where everyone wanted her to sit. Her family is unusually well-behaved. They don't sue each other, which is almost objectionable by everyone else's standards. All her children have lived. She's never lost a child. And her family own more, they're newcomers to the community, and they own more land than other people may have been comfortable with. She descends from a family who have been in a several decades long property dispute. So one of those things, obviously, lands right. her in court. We just don't know which one.
So it's interesting. So the accused were either disreputable women, women who were provocative, women who were flirtatious, women who, you know, were sort of outliers in that regard. But also, if you were too well off and too well behaved, so any way that you did not fit in with sort of the general community made you at risk for being accused, essentially.
That's true, although I'd say there's one exception, which is the men who are accused.
Right.
Of which there are quite a few. And in fact, there's a minister who will hang as a witch. And if you look at it closely, you begin to realize that the men who are accused are very often civic authorities who have had to tell people things people didn't want to hear. And sometimes they are former justices of the peace. In one case, it's a justice of the peace who very early on says, I don't feel like rounding up any more witches, and very shortly thereafter, he's accused. At one point, it's a skeptic. A very easy way to be accused was to express some sort of doubt about the proceedings. So that man lands in court. There's a difference there. Homeless 5-year-old girls and very rich merchants are equally accused. Their fates will be different, because a class thing is at work here, and if you were wealthy, you often managed to get out of jail free
right.
and get to New York. For the most part, the women who are accused are often sharp-elbowed, sharp-tongued, people who didn't fall into line. And those women are the ones who will hang, because bizarrely, if you confess to witchcraft, you generally did not hang.
That is bizarre.
That's bizarre.
So,
isn't it?
So in
really
other words,
logical, right?
You know, saying you're innocent was a sure way of assuring your guilt.
Yes, because
or this is ridiculous. If you said this is ridiculous, because that was the other thing that I thought was amazing, is that sort of as it progressed, the first people who were accused at least knew the witches. I mean, knew the afflicted. But eventually it got so you could just kind of pick anyone randomly in the community and say they were a witch, and they would get dragged in.
And it's worse than that, because the girls who were accusing, which are become a sort of core group of 8 or 10 adolescent and pre-adolescent girls, including one of these first two girls at the parsonage, are reaching beyond Salem very quickly, so that in the end, 24 communities will be affected. Andover, which is the next community over, most severely. There are more Andover accused witches than Salem accused witches, and more victims in Andover than in Salem. But we're not clear where they get the names. They obviously have never met most of these people. They're plucking names out of oral headlines, and often they're very rich people, very prominent people, somebody whom somebody might have been married to a generation earlier. It's unclear where they get the names they're getting.
So take us through a little bit the timeline. It started in January. When did they start bringing them all to trial? Because at first there was sort of just a bunch of accusations, and the jail was getting full, and then they had the trial.
All is in sort of a holding pattern, with people being accused left and right. I should say that at this point, there's no settled Massachusetts government. And a new charter and a new governor will arrive in May of 1692. That new governor will immediately seat a court to adjudicate the cases. It's unclear why there was that holdup. There are various theories for why no one had actually seated a court before then. The court then will get started early in the summer. And it will meet several times. It, needless to say, can't prosecute all the witches who've been jailed because so many people have been accused at this point. It will meet several times. The skeptics will be afraid. No one says a word, essentially, against the proceedings because the cost of doing so is so great. Skepticism will begin to grow toward the end of the summer. The first people who mention their doubts do so very tentatively and anonymously because it borders on sedition to question the court at this point, and the court will be shut down in October. So really, February to October is the course of the entire panic.
You know, give us a sense of the range of the accused. I mean, there were two dogs that were accused, and there were which I would love to hear about the dogs. As and Portland is a dog town, so I think everyone here would love to
hear
about
the dogs.
Well,
then let me just interrupt you and
just
say that.
Just go for it.
I spoke somewhere recently, and I said, you know, 14 women hang and 5 men, silence from the audience, and then I said, and 2 dogs, and the entire audience went, oh. We don't know that much about the dog victims who did not leave diaries. We don't even know what color they were. We know that one of them seems to be, when I mentioned the diabolical familiars that a witch has, one of them was thought to be the diabolical familiar of a justice of the peace in Andover, and he's the one who had refused to collect any more witches, and he's accused and his dog is shot. And the other dog appears to be shot because when he looks at one of the bewitched girls, she goes into spasms. And so he also is shot. And by the logic of the day, the most illustrious of New England ministers will later comment about these dog assassinations. If those dogs had been real devils, they wouldn't have died. So that tells you something about the kind of logic we're dealing with here.
Okay.
It's a little bit like if the witch sinks, she's innocent, you know?
Right, right. Well, and then there was a gentleman who was a 66-year-old Boston Sea captain who was guilty of other things, but and that sort of fed into the idea that he was also a witch because what he sold munitions to Indians, and so that meant that probably also it sort of slid over into being a witch.
You know, you bring 2 things to light, Karen. This is John Alden, who is good friends with some of the justices. And he's remarkable in that he comes into the hearing room. The men who are sitting on the court are men he's done business with. They're his neighbors. They're his co-parishioners. And standing in front of these men who've known him for decades and done business with him, the justices choose to go with the girls' accusations rather than to believe him, which points to the central astonishing thing here, which is that the teenagers are running the show, and that when they say, you know, we see the devil whispering into a witness's ear, a suspect's ear, even though no one else can see it, the justices will privilege that information over the suspect's standing for his innocence.
Right.
Alden, though, typifies something else, which is that everyone who comes into that room, like some of us, is guilty of something. And there were reasons for Alden to be in court. It just wasn't; those reasons just weren't witchcraft.
Right. Why do you think that it was, as you said, this moment in history where teenage girls really ran the show, and as it progressed, also what was really fascinating is that neighbors and people in the community would then bring their strange uncle or strange neighbor who they thought was suffering from something, would bring those to the girls for this sort of informal spiritual diagnosis. So their power, beyond being accusers, actually grew in the community.
It's astonishing, isn't it? They start simply as bewitched girls. Very soon they start to be oracles of a kind, and they will predict what's going to happen next. They will predict how many other witches will be identified. In the hearing room, they will say, so-and-so is now about to levitate, and that person will do so. I'm just wondering if that's about to happen.
I know.
Shortly thereafter, the judges begin to appeal to them. The judges realize that they are on slightly fragile ground here, and they're not entirely certain how this witchcraft thing works in all ways. And every once in a while, they'll appeal to the girls as the authorities, which we have on the court records, which is really striking. And then by the end of the summer, because the girls are so good at seeing these invisible forces, these spectral bodies, people will begin to treat them as if they are visionaries and to bring ailing relatives to the girls to say, can you tell us who's bewitching my poor sick child?
Right.
So it's really the tables are completely turned here.
And it's also interesting, there was a mother and daughter duo of the Putnams, Ann Senior and Ann Junior. And what degree do you think, because they were also a very sort of powerful, influential family in the community, and they were among the first accusers. If the accusers had been some of the sort of ne'er-do-wells, do you think it would have taken off this way? Was there an aspect of that they were city fathers and they were influential? do you think? Or?
And that's a hard one for me to speculate on because it's, you know, it's reversing what actually happens. I think it lends credence to the story that you have adult women who begin to testify
right.
to these events. The second adult woman who is supposedly bewitched in the hearing room will scream in pain, howl in pain, and say that she can feel the suspect reaching inside her and, you know, messing with her insides, and will take off her muff and throw it at the suspect in the middle of the meeting house. And when she misses her, she'll reach down and take her shoe instead and thwack the poor suspect with it. So there's a lot of just, you know, extraordinary acting out here. When an adult woman does that, it's different from a screaming teenage girl, obviously, but it's making the point more emphatically even.
Right. Before we talk about sort of how it organically resolved itself, tell us about the first hanging, because they were hanged. I think we think they were burned, but they were hanged. And Bridget Bishop was the first one, and she was sort of the poster girl, right, for sort of the unsavory witch. And her hanging was botched, right?
You really want to talk about that?
I do.
Oh, wow. Why don't we talk about the man crushed under stones while we're at it? Yeah, Bridget Bishop becomes the first suspect to be tried. There's clearly a lot of guessing going on once the court is seated about who the first person who's going to be brought to trial is going to be. And Bridget Bishop is a perfect victim, or a perfect first victim from a prosecutor's point of view, because she's been in court a lot. She's fought with her husband and been punished for it. She's a petty thief, and she's been prosecuted for it. She's lied in the courtroom, and there are decades of evidence against her. She has this remarkable tendency to hop into men's beds, or so they will testify in court, and annoy them in the middle of the night.
I hate when that happens.
And it's particularly interesting, as I point out in the book, because if you look at the court records, women often are molested in their beds by strange men, but there is no case of a man being molested in his bed by a woman, surprisingly, except in the witchcraft testimony, where women sneak into men's bedrooms and strangle them or suffocate them or pounce on them in the forms of big gray gleaming cats or balls of fire. And Bridget Bishop is one of those people. So from the prosecutor's point of view, she is the first one chosen. She is absolutely unrepentant. She's not willing to confess to witchcraft, which is why she will hang. And I don't know why I find this particularly poignant. She hangs alone. She's the only one who's hanged by herself, which I somehow find is worse. But yes, that is the first person to be hanged, at which point many people have begun to realize that confession isn't such a lousy thing to offer the authorities, because they obviously and are intending to do something about this epidemic.
Right. And then how did it sort of miraculously start to resolve itself? Like the girls, the afflicted became unafflicted. They got bored of it. It did wrap up pretty quickly. Once people started hanging, it was as if the whole kind of mentality of the town turned.
I think there is a point. I mean, like, terror burns itself out, and I think there is a point at which, first of all, the numbers become impossible. These accusations have multiplied exponentially. The jails are packed. You're almost unable to prosecute this many people. And the accusations have begun to reach a higher level, which is frightening to the authorities. Also, tentatively, people have weighed in. The governor has reached out to the New York ministers for a second opinion because he thinks maybe his own ministers aren't giving him all the information he needs. The New York ministers will come down on the side of moderation. There have been some very poignant and convincing petitions from court, from jail, on the part of some of the suspects. And also, it's fall, and everyone has spent the summer in meetings listening to witchcraft testimony. And they haven't been tilling their fields or filling their cellars, and it's about to get cold. So it's a somewhat inconvenient time of year to be listening to more witchcraft testimony, which may have something to do with it. In any case, it all begins to devolve very quickly into this feeling that perhaps they have overstepped and over-prosecuted. What's remarkable is that while they will realize that the court has overreached, the belief in witchcraft doesn't abate it by any means. And the feeling when the court is shut down is that the court may have perhaps prosecuted badly and may in fact have hanged innocents, but they have also let guilty witches go free. And even in 1693, the Massachusetts ministers are examining witchcraft cases.
And there was no one actually, when it ended, who sort of stood up and said, I'm accountable, right? Nobody kind of said I zigged and should have zagged and I shouldn't have.
All of the witchcraft justices, there are 9 men on that court, will continue in their roles in the Massachusetts administration. The chief justice will go on to become governor of Massachusetts. It's like the financial crisis, you know, nobody was responsible. There's no accountability. No one is held to account. One of the justices, Samuel Sewall, will famously apologize a few years later. He's the only justice who does so. And it is clear that the chief justice holds him in, he finds it humiliating that Sewall has done this and turns his back on him for acknowledging his role. There are very few apologies, and the apologies that are offered tend to be those kinds of apologies we all know so well. Samuel Parris, the minister in whose household this breaks out, will ultimately apologize by saying, I'm sorry if I did anything that you think was wrong. It's that kind of apology.
So we know where that came
now
from.
Now we know, yeah, that's the original New England apology, obviously. And one of the girls will apologize, as will some jurors later, this is, basically by saying, we were misled. It's almost as if they're accusing the authorities of not having better enlighten them. And if any fingers are pointed, they are basically pointed at that small supernatural figure at the scene, which is to say, the devil made me do it.
It always comes back
very
to that.
Very convenient.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your process here. I think there's a lot of writers in the audience, and you know, as a reader, well, actually, there is no one like you. The amount of research and the historical context and the degree that that your work is so readable, like a novel, as everyone sort of says.
For better or worse.
For better or worse, no, it's wonderful. But how did you, especially in this case, there was not a lot of actual documentation from the courts. It was all expunged. There were diaries, the letters, but really you were operating, you didn't have the central documents that would give you all the information about how this proceeded. I can't imagine how you were able to research this and construct it so seamlessly.
Remember that I was coming off a book about Cleopatra for which there was no documentation at all. So this was like a walk in the park.
Because people could write.
People could write and read, actually. The hearing papers exist. The trial papers have been lost somewhere along the way. So we have no trials. When you ask about what happens afterward, silence falls on this episode completely. So you'll be reading a incredibly meticulous, brilliantly detailed 17th century diary, and you'll read through 1691, and you get to 1692, and it's just not there. And then it moves on to 1693, or the sermon books from that summer will jump over the summer. The church record book was rewritten to leave these events out. So there were some sort of hideous holes in the story. So you're reaching elsewhere, and you're reaching for whatever other documentation you have. We have no diary from any of the girls. No Puritan girl leaves a diary. But we have elsewhere lots of indications of what it felt to be a girl in 17th century America. And I'm thinking here of Samuel Sewall, the justice's daughter, who's a 15-year-old, who a few years after the trials will show up at her father's bedside in tears because she's 15, but she's already committed so many sins that she has no hope for her salvation and is certain that she's a reprobate and her life is over and she can't stop crying. So she has what we would term sort of a nervous breakdown for the cure of which, believe it or not, she has packed off to Salem to recover. But there were a couple of those on the record which indicate how hard these girls are working, the strain of the religion on them. If you read Mary Rowlandson's captivity narrative, you see her yearning for a way, for an affliction by which to prove her piety. I mean, there are a lot of clues here as to what is preoccupying and undermining a woman in 17th century America.
Right.
So you're zigging and zagging among what you do have. I mean, I spent a lot of time with captivity narratives and with diaries because it was occurring to me early on that people often mistake one thing for another in the darkness, and that there were a tremendous number of times where someone would club a black dog on the doorstep and it would turn out to be a child, or someone would shoot the the spooky black figure that descended from the watchbox, and it would turn out not to be a marauding Indian, but a minister. That there was a huge sense here of figures mutating in the darkness and no one and everyone being very much on edge.
Right. So, and from a just like a boots on the ground business, how long do you research? Is there a point in time where you say, I'm done doing my primary research and now I'm writing? Like, how does it, you know, it took you 4 years from soup to nuts. And tell us sort of from a timeline perspective how you work.
I think I researched for about 112 years. And I have a pile of Puritan sermons in my office that is not something anyone would want to boast about. I researched for about 3 years. I tend to do the research before I even start to think about writing for precisely the reason I just mentioned. I don't know where I'm going, and I don't know what themes are going to emerge or how the book is going to be structured in any way. Even the part I read about witchcraft obviously took a lot of reading around before I began to notice, wait, New England witches don't fly, but continental witches fly. How did that idea make its way to America? And in fact, the book will reveal how it finds its way to Massachusetts in 1692. So I tend to really immerse myself in the research completely, but I'm still researching a little bit because as I finally do sit down to write, which we've both compared to sort of going into that submarine mode where you leave your real life and your loved ones behind for several years, which they always appreciate, you're always realizing something you didn't know and that you have to go back into the library to research. And this is such a deeply documented period in terms of the last couple of hundred years of scholarship that I if I hadn't had a deadline, I would still be researching it.
Right.
Actually, I wouldn't mind continuing to research it.
Did you do a substantial amount of research before you actually decided to write about witches? Like, is there a preliminary period where you're sort of looking around for your next topic that requires research? Or were you just enchanted and you thought, witches, that's my next topic?
I do enough research to think there's a book here. There are always, I always find anyway that there are terrifying surprises, like there were no 17th century newspapers, something I hadn't grasped when I started. I thought, oh great, I'll look at the newspaper accounts, not realizing there was no press.
Right.
But I tended to find diabolical talking cats and goblins and things rather irresistible, yeah.
So what, you know, and this is, again, this is sort of for the writers in the group, and maybe it's a little bit of inside baseball here, but what, you know, when you're relying heavily on research material, there's a point where you absorb it, you process it, and then it comes out, and it is uniquely your voice, even though it's based on all of these facts. Is it just, I mean, how do you get that mojo going? I think it takes a lot of confidence to then take a period in history that has been written about, plays have been, I mean, it's been all over, and yet you are going to kind of retell the story, you know, with your own voice. Is there a time when you wake up? I mean, do you work into it? Like, how does that happen? Well, I'm asking for your magic here, by the way.
I impart it wholeheartedly. I think a publisher's deadline is a very effective tool. So I knew the clock was ticking to some extent. There is a point, and you know this as well as I, Karen, that where you start to boil over, where you just, you know where the book, I knew the broomstick crash, it's not a broomstick, in fact. I wanted it to be a broomstick, but it's not a broomstick, it's a lousy pole. The pole crash was the beginning, and I knew that for some time. And you just get to the point where you realize you don't know. It's like your headlights are on, but just barely. You know where you're going a little bit, and you figure you're starting out, and you're hoping that you're going to illuminate the path as you go a little bit further. It is an act of utter faith and delusion,
right.
Actually sitting, for me anyway. And it's very easy to lose, to fall off the horse, or
right.
At least I fall off the horse 150 times a
right.
day. It does acquire, I find, a certain momentum of its own once you're once your X number of pages in, it has a viability anyway,
right.
That will, I find, gives you enough momentum to keep going.
Well, and I think that was something that we were talking about before this, and it you know, and I think it's encouraging for anybody that wants to write or do something creative is that you know, you have written a number of amazing acclaim, like you know, these books that you should be like a master, and of course you are, but when we start, we were saying how it's always the same. You're always looking at this material saying, am I out of my mind? There's nothing here. I'm going to have to, you know, get a job at Starbucks. That it's always the same process. Can you talk about that?
I was thinking
that?
Yoga instructor, actually. the thing I would be least suited to do in the world. We were talking about how writing always reminds you what an imbecile you are, because it doesn't get any easier. And I find each book is different, because through calculated means, I've wanted every book to be different and possibly more challenging. But I don't feel as if I take anything from the prior book that I can necessarily apply the next time around. So I'm reinventing the wheel and myself, and I come to it as an utter neophyte each time, which is infuriating, because you would think you'd have learned something. I mean, I still stupidly do my footnotes the same inefficient way every time. So yes, I feel as if I was talking to a neurosurgeon recently who said he'd seen it all and he could fix it all, and I was thinking, I'll never get to that point where I'll feel that I'm in command of my craft.
I find that so hard to believe. So we're almost out of time here, but can you tell us what's next up? What's coming after The Witches?
I thought everyone had come with an idea for me. there's a glimmer of something, but I'm still, for lack of a better word, pretty enchanted by this material. And there's one piece I'd like to write, which was sort of parallel to the book. And once that's out of my system, I tend to take a deep dive into the new material, and I'm not yet ready to do that. I think I should probably remind my children what I look like, and then I can do that.
Right. Thank you so much, Stacy, and thank you, everyone, for coming.
That was Stacy Schiff and Karen Carbo at Wordstock, Portland's Book Festival in 2015. I'm Andrew Proctor, the host of The Archive Project, and we're here at Literary Arts with Karen Carbo.
Hi, Andrew. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. Karen is both a writer, of course. We're going to talk about her writing. She is also a board member of Literary Arts. She's also a supporter of Wordstock and did some interviewing for us in 2015. And particularly, you interviewed Stacy Schiff.
Right, The Witches.
The Witches.
The Witches, yeah.
Which is a really funny conversation, despite its gruesome content of the book. Like, how does that happen? And what's the relationship between that sort of macabre humor and that sort of really dark material?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, part of it with The Witches is that it's been so sort of codified. And I think, you know, there's probably also like a kind of Halloween component to it. And the other thing is, and Stacy wrote a lot about this, is sort of the way that they were tried and the way that they were punished, even though it's horrific.
Right.
It still winds up being, as you said, sort of this darkly comedic thing, you know. And,
right. Isn't a dog indicted at one point?
There was
as a witch.
A dog.
At some point?
A dog was a witch, and also there were a lot of, a lot of the evidence was sort of women kind of flying, leaving their homes and like flying around at night,
right,
and showing up. I mean, it was the idea that it even happened, I think, is sort of subtextually very, very alarming, especially given what's sort of going on now in contemporary times.
Right.
But I think because, you know, it happened so long ago and there was no real evidence, it was all this kind of bizarre hearsay is what makes it sort of so, you know, comedic.
Right. Well, in the age of no internet, where is the evidence? No phones, no emails. Like, it's just this sort of...
Well, it's all hearsay, and it's all, you know, men basically testified, and also sometimes kind of, you know, the sort of women of the town who were sort of the landed ladies of the town.
Right.
But really, it was sort of men. And they were the other thing that was sort of amazing is that they were these young girls. They were like teenage girls.
Right.
They were like 13.
Right.
And we forget about that. I mean, as the witch hunt progressed, there were, as you said, there were dogs and there were older men and stuff. But it started out just being these young girls, these sort of mean girls.
Right.
Who were talking trash about other young girls.
Right.
So,
and
you know,
somehow that just escalates out of all proportion.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that Stacy did, I think, that was, and it's something that I really admire about her, is that she does a lot of very deep digging in terms of research and in terms of putting the witches in the context of the time.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we all, I mean, myself included, sort of have this fourth grade understanding of the colonies and...
Right. Everyone's in funny hats.
Everyone's in funny
buckle
hats.
Shoes.
And buckle shoes. And there's the sort of dubious Thanksgiving. Like, what's that about?
Right.
But, you know, forgetting that it was this tiny colony of very strange foreign people in this land that you know...
Who are radicals.
Very radical. And radicals, black sheep, and weirdos. Like, that is what the United States, you know, that's our genetic immigrant DNA.
Right. Still showing today.
It's still showing today. And, you know, religious radicals.
Yeah.
But also surrounded by very scary wilderness.
Right.
And so, you know, the sense that they really didn't have control of their environment to the degree that we assume they did. So being able to, like, blame everything that was inexplicable on a witch, you know, I think that it helped them feel like they were in control.
So surely the witches have been written about a bajillion times, right, in history. And so here you have Stacey Schiff in the middle of her career. You know, she could write about anybody. What's the ad, do you think? Is it this idea of context that her work sort of adds to our understanding of this moment in history, or is there something else going on here for Stacey?
You know, I think that it's one of those things that comes around that feels relevant today, even though it's also somewhat ludicrous, that there is this idea of quite literally... you know, especially with the rise of Hillary Clinton, you know, regardless of what happens, the rise of ambitious women, and how somewhat terrifying that is. It's not, and it's not just terrifying to men. It's terrifying to women who, I think, are happy fulfilling more traditional gender roles, who are not happy to upset the apple cart. So, you know, certainly, like I said, what happened then, you know, there's reverberations with what's happening now.
Well, So there's a really incredible remark that she makes that I felt like got a little lost in the event itself. But, and of course, you know, the beauty of re-listening to these things is you catch something you missed the first time.
Right.
Where she said, well, you know, in some ways, and this is sort of a hopeful phrase in the context of today, even though it's dark, which is that at some point terror burns itself out.
Right.
Is what she says, right? Like, so that it just... somehow that just can't keep going, or it'll just consume the entire community, right? I mean,
I think once it's done serving its purpose, you know, that there's a few lunatics that kind of keep it spinning for a while, but kind of the mass hysterical portion of it, it burns out.
Because it just threatens to consume everybody at some point, right? And then everyone's like, wait a minute,
Right.
Obviously, a lot of your work has been about women. You know, whether you consider yourself a feminist writer or not is something for you to tell me. But obviously also Stacey Schiff's writing, though not entirely, is primarily, like her books are primarily about women in history and rewriting the lives of women in history. Think about Cleopatra, Vera Nabokov, The Witches, which are a group biography, obviously, but sort of biography in a way. How do you think about feminism, your work, and how do you think Stacey looks at it?
I can't obviously speak to what motivates Stacey. I mean, she also is writing, you know, she's writing very, very broadly in a time. So it's always like her person, her woman or women are always in a very broad historic period.
Yep.
My own approach to these women is very much kind of looking at them through very contemporary lenses. So, you know, one of the things you find, and I think this is true for anybody, it's always amazing when people read history of any sort, is that, oh, wow, this is like in Plato's time, this has been going on.
Right.
That you always are stunned at how human beings have been doing the same things to each other and to themselves, you know, over and over again. So one of the things that really interests me is that when I look at you know, these women, that some of their struggles, their internal struggles, and the things they were pushing against are very, it's all the same old story. And I'm very interested in then how they were able to actually do what they did, do the work that they did, have the lives that they did, push back against, you know, what they did. And, you know, and that's sort of the intellectual answer. You know, you're speaking, I think, in particular, the so-called Kick-Ass Women series.
Yeah.
Where I kind of, it's a kind of genre-bending thing where I've created these sort of biographies, memoir, self-help, philosophy books about Katharine Hepburn, Georgia O'Keeffe, Coco Chanel, and Julia Child. And the first book, I think, came out in about 10 years ago, 2007. So I've been going around talking about these books for a long time and basically saying what I just said to you. And I was on a panel with Cheryl Strayed a couple years ago, and I gave that rap. And she said, do you really think that's why you write these books? And I was like, well, absolutely. Didn't I not just say?
Right.
Yes,
I
do.
Abundantly clear.
So from a personal level, you know, one of the things that interests me about particularly those women and all the women that I tend to be attracted to is that they're extraordinarily long-lived. You know, not only do they have second acts, but they have third acts, like long after people think they're dead.
Right.
You know, when Georgia O'Keeffe's work was included in Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party, everyone said, oh, she's dead. And she was like the only living one.
Huh.
So they're like, no, I'm still alive. So anyway, so I'm attracted to these women that are very long lived. And I think from a personal perspective, my own mother died when I was 17.
Huh.
And I had no older aunts, no grandmothers, no cousins, no older women.
Mm.
It was, you know, when she died, she was 46. It was just a desert. So
yeah.
I've gotten to kind of be parented and mentored by these historic women who, you know, I can read about and I can learn from. And, you know, they kept going in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s and their 70s and their 80s. And so I get to be part of this,
right,
this sort of chain of
and
women.
And see yourself in those ages, right?
One
and
hopes,
professionally,
yeah,
and right, otherwise, right?
Right?
I mean, you get to, these
right,
are, we're looking for models always, it,
right,
right?
Right, right. So she pointed that out to me after many years of me saying what I said to you. So
the brain answer versus the heart answer.
Right, right.
This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.